Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Darren Lewis of the Daily Mirror, and Adi Oladipo, the journalist and broadcaster. Business as usual? Hardly. Liverpool may lead the Premier League, but they've got the worst defensive record in a top flight. Their unbeaten league run at Anfield extends to 63 matches, yet they're in damage limitation mode. In many ways, the champions sum up a surreal season. They and Manchester City can't afford to take their eyes off the Champions League before they meet on Sunday. But it bears repeating, this season is a tale of the unexpected. We can't take anything for granted at the moment, can we, Darren?
Absolutely not, Mike. I think as far as every team in the Premier League right now is concerned, they have weaknesses. I think there is a stat that says that this is the first time in Premier League history that no team is undefeated, which is quite interesting, but just shows how injuries and the coronavirus have levelled the playing field, because you can't now go into any given weekend certain of a result, even between the supposed heavyweights and the smaller teams. I think it's healthy, obviously, for the competition and for us as people who want to be entertained from the matches. But I think as far as the invincibility of Liverpool is concerned, they're top. But goodness me, the stats, you can hide behind all sorts of stats, but since they were crowned champions, no other team in the Premier League has conceded as many goals. And I think that tells you everything.
I did talk about them being in damage limitation mode, Addy. The consensus is that it'll take around about 80 points to win the title this season. Do you agree with that?
Possibly. I don't think any team's going to touch that 100 mark like Liverpool and City have done for the last two, three seasons. I think that's not going to happen. I can't see a team going on a run of 20 games unbeaten. Like Darren said, it's just not the way this season is planning out to be, because of COVID, because of injuries, because of VAR. We probably might touch on that in a minute as well. So I think there are a few reasons as to why I think 80-85 points might win it. For Liverpool, though, with regards to obviously conceding as many goals as they have, I don't know if Klopp will be as concerned as he should be, bearing in mind 7 of those goals are against Villa, 3 of those goals are against Leeds. So that's 10 already. I mean, since then, especially if you take in consideration all the injuries with Van Dijk and Matip and Fabinho, I think he'll be relatively pleased with how the defence has shored itself up, kind of, since that capitulation against Aston Villa. Look, in the end of the day, it's how the table looks. And I think Klopp, if you asked him, when you looked at the fixture list, having played Chelsea, Arsenal, Merseyside Derby, I think he'll be relatively happy with where Liverpool are this season when you add in the injuries and the inconsistency of what the coronavirus has brought.
And that's quite important, isn't it? Because I think the next game is against Manchester City next Sunday. Now, City don't have Jesus and they don't have Aguero, so they're missing that killer instinct in the box. I know that they've got Sterling and Sterling can score goals, and they're trying to convert Ferran Torres into a centre-forward from a winger, but the bottom line is they don't have that killer instinct, that hunger for smelling goals that Aguero has, obviously, at the highest class. Jesus not quite at the same level, but still is an option, or was an option. And it surprised me in the summer that they didn't go for another striker, because I think you need that depth if you are going to continue dominating, and even just to freshen things up at City anyway. So from Liverpool's point of view, they won't take it for granted by any stretch of the imagination, but I think given the circumstances, they'll be, like you say, Addy, relaxed going into the next few games. They've got Manchester City away on Sunday, then they've got Leicester at home, then they've got Brighton away. I mean, these are all matches that they would be confident of being able to get through, even with the injuries that they've got.
Mm. They've got Atalanta. They're in Atalanta on Wednesday in Bergamo. They will be punished for the sort of passive defending they showed, you know, through Gomez against West Ham, won't they? But what about further forward, Addy? Diogo Jota, goals in his first three home games. That means he emulates Kenny Dalglish, which can never be bad in Liverpool terms. It's interesting, isn't it? It's almost you score three, we'll score four, isn't it?
Yeah, it is now. It almost reminds me of the Newcastle teams under Kevin Keegan, which were always similar to that as well. I think Jota, though, I think has proven to be a shrewd signing. Like, look, I put my hands up when Liverpool signed him for, what, 41 million. I was like, what are they doing? That's a lot of money, especially when they were linked with Timo Werner for around the same amount of money. I was slightly concerned. He wasn't a player that was going to immediately start in Liverpool's team as a player that was going to come off the bench. But four goals in nine games, I think he's showing that he can add something a bit different. Pressure on Firmino now. He's put so much pressure on Jurgen Klopp that Jurgen Klopp played all four of them last week in a game, didn't he? So I think he's been an excellent sign-in. I think I'm still a bit shocked that Wolves sold him, but again, the money was so big, so why not? Going back to Atalanta and being punished by Atalanta, I think Gasperini's done a fantastic job of Atalanta. Third last season, should have got to the semi-finals of the Champions League. Obviously, were unlucky against PSG. But they themselves conceded four against Napoli. They conceded three against Sampdoria, two against Ajax. Liverpool will equally punish them if they make mistakes as well. So it's not two teams that don't concede goals. Both do, which should make it an exciting game. But I don't think Liverpool should be scared of Atalanta.
Yeah, but to be fair, I think that Liverpool defence should bear in mind that Luis Muriel, the Colombian striker, scored five in his last seven, and Alejandro Gomez scored five in his last eight. So they know where the goal is, especially Muriel. He is a guy who can smell the threat and the uncertainty. And I know that Nat Phillips, I'm sure we might talk about him, the 23-year-old centre-half who stepped in to the breach and did well, actually. He won more aerial duels than any other player during that game at the weekend. But I just think that Muriel will test him. You know, just talking to a couple of player ex-pros, they were saying that what you want to do in situations like that is find the weakness in the young players, you know, see if they've got the understanding with centre-halves that come from the kind of leadership that Van Dijk provides, and maybe try to exploit that if it isn't there. Get him doing stuff that he doesn't want to do. And I think both those players will look to try and see if they can target him. So there'll be a lot of responsibility on Joe Gomez or whoever plays alongside Nat Phillips, if he does play in that game, given that Fabinho's not around, to really work on the understanding between them in that back line. I think last season, a few teams took Atalanta for granted and paid the price. So in the Champions League, I'm sure Liverpool won't, but if they do, they'll pay the price themselves.
Yeah, I suppose it just points up, doesn't it, the unrelenting nature of this season, Addy. Neither Liverpool nor City can afford to have one eye on Sunday's game, can they? City have probably got the easier task of the two. They've got Olympiacos at home. But again, managers at the moment are almost managing on the hoof, aren't they?
They are. But what I think Liverpool have done is they've mixed it around in the midfield, what Klopp likes to call his engine room. They've mixed it up front as well. We've started to see Shaqiri come back in to the fold. Minamino's got quite a few minutes as well. So I think he still will try and mix it up. And then it goes back to Jota being in the squad now. You feel comfortable now to say, okay, Firmino, you sit out this one. Jota can come in. Origi will get minutes as well. So I think Liverpool will try and mix it up. They clearly can't mix it up at the back, and that's a problem. But I think Liverpool will go into this Champions League game a bit more confident than previous Champions League campaigns, which have got off to a horrendous start. Liverpool normally go into the last Champions League game needing to win. Now it's 6 points from six, which is good for Liverpool, believe it or not. So I think they'll be a bit more confident knowing that they can get a point against Atalanta. A point is a good result, whereas in previous seasons, they had to win. I do think Klopp will have one eye on the game against City on Sunday. Look, it's not what it used to be. It's not a title-deciding game, but it's still a very important game. And I think that's because of the Michelin result and it's because of the Ajax result. I think Liverpool will be a bit more confident going to this one.
Yeah, just a word on Mike, on Michael Edwards. I mean, I agree with what Eddie was saying about Jota. And in the avalanche of games that we have at the moment, sometimes it does get missed. The job that the guys in charge of recruitment do. But Jota, he costs so much because he's so versatile. He does so many jobs and he's answered a few problems for Liverpool in this difficult period. Firmino's not scoring any goals and he comes and he scores three in his last three for Liverpool. And, you know, if Salah needs to be taken off, Jota's available to come in there. Shaqiri as well, you know, the decision to keep him, that has proven to be a good one. But, you know, I just want to talk about Michael Edwards because Liverpool get, everyone says Liverpool are one-dimensional, that Jurgen Klopp is the man, and clearly he's done a fantastic job, but you can't do that job without quality players. What you said, Addy, wasn't just a sort of passing thing, because I was the same as you when they spent £45 million on Jota, and I thought, whoa, that looks like a lot of money to me. You know, but they clearly realised what he could provide. They clearly realised his versatility. They clearly realised that he had the ability to not only score goals, but provide a work rate that makes players integral to what they're trying to do at Liverpool. And people say, well, will he eventually repay that transfer fee? I think he's doing it already because he's helping them to rest their way through this very difficult period for them. And I think he's been a super signing.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I'll take your point, Darren, because from my experience of observing recruitment teams, Liverpool's is one of the best simply because it plans long term. You know, the players that they bring in have probably been looked at, analysed, scrutinised, both in terms of their character and their on-field performances for probably 18 months. So it's not a quick, oh my Lord, we're in trouble here, we need to go and buy someone and throw a bit more money at the wall. So, and it's all unobtrusive. There are very, very few fanfares when Liverpool get involved in transfer business. I just want to make a comparison, if I could actually, Addy, with City. Now, on Saturday, they fielded the most expensive defence in Premier League history, cost £230 million. We all know how much money surrounds that football club. Are the owners getting value for that money?
For now, probably not. I say for now because I still think that there's a good partnership there in the centre of that defence. I'm still not convinced with Mendy. I've never been convinced with Mendy, if I'm honest with you, since he arrived. I think Kyle Walker's improving again. And it sounds strange to say he's improving because he's 30 years old, but I thought there was a dip. I thought he's come again from that dip. And I think he's done extremely well to recover from that dip as well. When you think of him being left out of the England squad, you think of the breaches of coronavirus that he had during lockdown. I think he's really come on leaps and bounds, but it still doesn't look like a title winning defence. I don't look at it and think this is a defence like what Chelsea had under Mourinho or what United had in its heyday under Ferguson or even what Liverpool had last season with Matip and Van Dijk and Gomez and Trent and Alex and Andy Robertson. It just doesn't feel like that with me. And I don't think he has the confidence in it as well, which is why he's tinkered with it for so long. It's going to be an interesting one with City this season. I think this is Pep Guardiola's worst team he's had since he's been at City. I really do. That could be because of the David Silva going and again company probably not being replaced, Aguero not being what Aguero was, Jesus injured, Sane leaving, Bernardo Silva not being Bernardo Silva anymore. It's a strange rebuilding job he's got there, but I feel like if I'm City owners, I look at the squad and look at the amount it costs and I'm not happy with it right now.
Do you think, Darren, that the rebuilding job that Addy just spoke about will actually be completed by Pep Guardiola. You know, there's a lot of talk about him going back to Barcelona because of the new presidential elections. He says no, but I suppose he would, wouldn't he, at the moment? You know, you can look at it that it would make an awful lot of sense. You know, Pep Guardiola is a cultural icon. He's a political touchstone. He's a favoured son who's just become a prodigal son for Catalonia. And of course they want him to come home. And it does make sense, doesn't it?
In theory, it does. But Koeman already has made a good start at Barcelona. There was a very important win last week in the Champions League over Juventus. And it wasn't just the win, but it was the demeanour of Lionel Messi in that game. Supplied a superb ball for the first goal. Celebrated as though it meant something in that second, when he's got dispatched a penalty for the second. And he just appeared to have shaken off the drama of the summer when it looked like he was trying to force that move to Manchester City. And I think Koeman is going to be given time. I know that the new man's going to be coming in, but how do you replace a guy who's getting results? And I think Koeman, not only is he getting results, I know he had a disappointing one preceding the Juventus game, but he does look like he's re-energised the squad and he's trying to do different things, and he's got Ansu Fati playing well as well. You know, he looks like he's rebuilding this side. The big thing for Guardiola as well, I wonder if Guardiola wants to prove that he can win Champions Leagues without Messi, because that's the thing. You go back to Barcelona and you're the guy who can't win unless you've got Messi in your team. We know he can win leagues. He's done it in Germany. He's done it in England. But can he win the Champions League? Zidane has been, you know, Zidane's got a collection of them in his mantelpiece, you know. He just does it for fun. You know, like we record podcasts, you know, Champions League, thank you very much, you know.
Fun?
But yeah, exactly. Whereas Guardiola just can't do it. And you talk about the money that he spent. That's significant. It really is significant because, you know, you look at centre-half, right? Ever since Van Dijk's gone, I don't think he's brought in another centre-half with the leadership that Van Dijk had, not just on that back four, but at the club per se. And he spent fortunes trying to achieve that and has not managed to do it. I think you look in other areas of the pitch, you know, he brought in Sané. I thought Sané was terrific at first. He's gone and sold him. There are a number of players in positions where he's brought them in. Do they work? No, even the goalkeeper he brought in before Edison. Who was the goalkeeper he brought in before Edison?
Bravo.
Claudio Bravo. Realised, no, because he replaced Hart with Bravo, then replaced Bravo with Edison. And Edison has done fantastic, to be fair. But the fact, the point I'm trying to make is he's gone through a lot of money trying to find these formulas that Real Madrid seem to get fairly easily. Liverpool have managed to get without spending anywhere near as much money. And so I think he would, I just think that if he were to go back to Barcelona, I don't think that would be progress for him. And I think he would be more likely, given that his contract isn't signed, and given that he's spent a long time at City, more than he spent at any other club, I wonder if he might take a sabbatical. He does like some time away from the game, and I think he might do that.
I think he honestly might wave the white flag at City. I really do. We talk about the money he spent. I don't think he wants to do, and he's ready to do a rebuild job at City. I think they've got fantastic young players coming through. I think Phil Foden is an excellent player, and I think he's going to go on to prove that he is a genuine world-class player, and he could be in England's midfield for years to come. But I like the Barcelona link. It's not just Victor Font that's interested in him if he gets elected. If Laporta gets elected, I spoke to Semra Hunter, who works for La Liga TV, and she'll send both of those, have earmarked Guardiola as their number one choice, Xavi as number two, but Guardiola's number one.
But Adi, is that progress if he goes back there in terms of his career?
Considering where Barcelona are now, the prodigal son coming home to make them champions again, to almost wrestle it away from Real Madrid and win another Champions League. I don't think it's progress necessary for him, but I think Barcelona fans are almost looking at it like the Messiah is coming back. And that's why, yeah, I think it could work.
Because it's such an emotionally driven football club, isn't it? That's the thing. Mm. Because it's associated with so much more than football. You know, that's why I mentioned earlier on, he is this cultural and political icon there. And it does make a lot of sense. I take your point, Darren, about it being probably a step backwards in career terms. But what I would say is that Ronald Koeman, to me, looks like a stopgap. You know, OK, he has his own place in Barcelona's history with that free kick at Wembley, which got them the European Cup. But I just think that if Pep Guardiola wants to go, he will go and can go. And having said all that, you know, football makes mugs of everyone, and certainly me. You know, only last Thursday on this podcast, we were basically saying, well, that's it. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's got his security, no problem. You know, he's brilliant in Europe. He's proved he's a viable manager. Not that long later, everyone's saying, Solskjaer, not up to it. They lose to Arsenal in pretty abject fashion, and his future's back on the agenda. Is that fair, Darren?
I've got to tell you, I was never of the opinion. I have a WhatsApp message that I sent to a little group that I'm on where I was just incredulous after last, what's it, Tuesday, when they beat Leipzig for two reasons. Previously, all sorts of questions abounded about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's ability, tactical ability to manage the club, you know, people still making that suggestion that were he not a former player, would the manager of Mould have had the job at Manchester United? And suddenly a result that utterly flattered Manchester United. I know people go, oh, we got these tactics right. Well, he played five at the back because United can't defend. That's the reason he played five at the back, for no other reason. They're susceptible to pace. They've got no leadership or organisation at the back. And as soon as they play a side that know what they're doing, they are going to get beaten. And I've never been convinced by Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. So nothing that's happened in the last week or so has been a surprise. I've said on his podcast before, Michael, Manchester United under Solskjaer are a team you simply cannot trust. They can get a decent result one week and they can stink the place out the week after. And I still think that there are disciplinary issues there. I think that he doesn't have the authority that he believes himself to have, or that some people believe he may have. Graham Souness did a piece at the weekend about the fact that maybe things didn't work out with the likes of Mourinho and Van Gaal because they were very clear about the players they wanted and the club had their own ideas. And Solskjaer is somebody who indulges that, allows them to do that, because everybody knows that they were crying out for some leadership and some pace in that defence in the transfer window, and they bought Cavani, a guy who was available at the start of the window in a free transfer. And the buying policy looks scattergun. It doesn't help him. But in terms of him, I'm not convinced. He could have a result next weekend and win 4 or 5 nil. I still wouldn't be convinced, because for me, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is not the right man to be in charge of Manchester United.
Why do you think they're so poor at Old Trafford in the Premier League? I think it's 3 draws, 3 defeats in the last 6, and so good away where they've won their last 6. Equally, they're inconsistent in terms of, you know, being pretty naive or certainly wrong tactically in the Premier League, but getting away with it in the Champions League. How do you actually explain that?
Absolutely no idea. It's honestly, it's the million-dollar question with Manchester United. I tweeted after the game yesterday, I find the club, the players, the managers, everything about associated with United very strange. They're a 1-in-3 team. Marcus Rashford will look world-class for 1 game out of 3. Pogba 1 out of 3. Fernandes 1 out of 3. That's what I expect them to do. Like Darren Lewis said, they could win on the weekend 4-0. That's what they will do. Extremely inconsistent, devoid of leaders, devoid of characters. I watch them set up and I don't know what they're trying to do. When I look at Arteta, who's coming to Arsenal, I can see what he's trying to do. I can actually see what Lampard is trying to imprint on Chelsea very early. I remember when Klopp came and the results were inconsistent at Liverpool in his first season, but I could actually understand and see what he was trying to do. 100 games now at Manchester United for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and I still don't know what the plan or the ideas are. They're no longer the force they were in the transfer window. Yes, they'll attract players because they pay the biggest wages. But in terms of identifying players that they want at the club, they can't do it anymore. You think of January transfer window, trying to get Haaland, their number one target, couldn't do it. The summer window, Sancho, number one target, couldn't do it. United are in big problems. And I think sometimes they pope over the cracks with the wins against the PSGs and the Leipzigs. But if you step back and look at it from a bigger picture, it's all over the place. Donny van de Beek came in. again, almost like a panic buy. I'm not quite sure what he brings to the table. Good young player, but he doesn't fit what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was trying to create at the club. Real big trouble for United. And sorry, I can't answer your question in more detail, Michael, because it's such a difficult question to answer.
How about this one then? If you're Solskjaer, do you keep Paul Pogba?
Absolutely not. He has to go. And I don't think they should be scared of him going as well. It reminds me a bit of when Coutinho wanted to leave Liverpool. And I think every club is always in arms when their best player wants to leave. You can move on. Pogba's been so inconsistent for United. I know Graham Souness likes to dig him out, but Graham Souness likes to dig him out because he's the best player. And sometimes you want to see the best player deliver all the time. He's been so inconsistent, it's scary. I kind of feel sorry for him. He's been played in so many different positions. He's played the left of a front three against Arsenal. He's been seeing him in a defensive holding midfield position. His best position is in an attacking midfield position. Attacking midfielder, let Pogba do what he does for France and you might get the best of him. I feel like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer doesn't know how to utilise him. And if he doesn't know how to utilise him or he doesn't want to utilise him in his best position, let him go.
Yeah, one of the many terrific points you've just made, Adi, Arteta and the contrast between his certainty and Solskjaer's uncertainty. You know, that was Arsenal's first win at Old Trafford since September 2006. You know, first win at the Premier League's top six for, I think, 5 years, 29 games. How important and how significant is Arteta's, as I said, sense of certainty? He knows where he's going, doesn't he?
I would say it's so important that if Pogba were playing for Arsenal, Arteta would get the best out of him. I find this... that's probably one of the few things you and I disagree on, Adi, because I think every time Manchester United lose, Pogba gets it. It used to be that every time Arsenal lost, Wenger got it, and you Arsenal fan TV was unmissable. Now, every time Manchester United lose, Pogba gets it. But it's misdirection. Because it's symptomatic, and it was very interesting, like Mike says, about the many good points you made. You talked about the many positions that Pogba has played in. That smacks of a guy in charge who doesn't know the player's best position. And if you bring in a quality player, it is your job to get the best out of that player. If he isn't scoring or assisting, then you are not deploying him in the right way. And for me, if he were playing for Arteta, there would be a very clear idea of what his job is, because when you look at those players playing for Arteta, they know their jobs. But okay, you might say that one or two results haven't gone their way, but I'll be honest, when he arrived, when he got the job ahead of Carlo Ancelotti, I thought, well, you know, maybe he's got it because it's the thing, you know, he's Pep Guardiola's number two, and it's sexier to get him in rather than a guy who's been around the racetrack a few times. But he's come in, he's been consistent with his tactics, he's been clear about the direction that he wants to take the club in, he's jettisoned Guendouzi when he showed even the slightest amount of dissent, he's got rid of Ozil, who's probably now the most expensive Twitter cheerleader of all time. You know, I mean, what a waste of a footballer. Get yourself off Twitter and find a club and play some football instead of congratulating Arsenal on victories. And, you know, okay, some of the other stuff that he's doing is worthy, but you're a footballer. Go and play football. Take a wage cut. Arteta has done a fantastic job in asserting the kind of authority that Solskjaer doesn't have. When you go to a football club, you live and you die by your decisions. You go in, you assert that authority, and then you keep it consistent by being clear about what you want from your players. At Arsenal, that exists. At Man United, it doesn't exist. It didn't exist at Arsenal under Unai Emery. He never had that authority. And at one stage, even the club's Twitter feed, we were bantering, I hate that word, but bantering about him. That's not happening with Arteta. And that's why I think that they are heading in a really, really good direction. Even when the bad results come, you can stomach those ones because you see what he's trying to do. I can't see it with Solskjaer. They've spent a lot of money. They've got better players than the results that they're getting at the moment. Oh, sorry, than the performances that they're getting at the moment. And I think that's down to him. That's the big contrast between the two.
Yeah, and if you look at it, you've got in Arteta, a coach who was probably making players better. You look at Elneny, he's basically resurrected his Premier League career, isn't he? And also, look at the defence. You know, basically, they were a standing joke last season, and now they've got the best defensive record in the Premier League. Gabriel looks a real defensive unit. Add that to good transfers. Thomas Partey is an obvious example. And the mixture's right, isn't it, Eddie?
Yeah, he's ticking all the boxes, is Arteta. Darren was just eulogising about him there, and I was just almost thinking about how good Arteta and the job he is doing. I think Gabriel looks a mountain, doesn't he? Almost got that kind of Van Dijk present, looks big, looks strong. For someone so young as well, I always see him barking out instructions. And I guess that's one benefit with no fans. You can actually hear who talks, and Gabriel talks a lot. You spoke about Elneny there, obviously on loan at Besiktas. You kind of feel sometimes when you go on loan, that's it, you're out of the door. Arteta did say, look, he's going to give everyone a clean slate. He's stuck to his word. He's given Elneny a go. And I almost feel, he said something about Elneny yesterday, which was interesting. He says, what did he say? He said he likes players with no egos. And I think that's a dig at Guendouzi, who I think has the ego. But Arsenal have always had a soft belly in the midfield. You look at it now, watching the game yesterday, him and Partey, and that's done. They are now a strong midfield. Tierney looks good. Bellerin looks like he's got that yard of pace back. I'm still a bit concerned with Aubameyang, if I'm honest with you. He will come good. I think he's a top striker. But, I mean, since he signed the contract, and look, I don't want to make the comparison, but the parallels are there. Since he signed that contract, we haven't seen the Aubameyang. Look, I think he'll come good. I think Pepe's starting to improve. Willian looks a good signing. So, yeah. So far, so good for Arteta. It's going to take him two or three more windows, I think, to get the team he really wants. But so far, so good. I mean, look, Holding. Look what he's done with Holding. Holding was supposed to be on his way to Newcastle. Now, all of a sudden, Holding and Gabriel look like a good defensive partnership. So, yeah, a lot of boxes have been ticked for Arteta.
What about Chelsea, Darren? You know, they win at home against Rennes on Wednesday, and that'll probably set them up for qualification from their Champions League group. Maundy's obviously given them stability at the back. Is Frank Lampard now beginning to work out what sort of team he needs to field?
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, I think he was very clear about what he needed to work on most was that defence, because they were scoring goals last season, but they were just being undermined by the lack of certainty in goal. Sorry, the complete uncertainty in goal and the lack of leadership in his defence. Silva provides that in that back four, and Mendy is so unobtrusive. They've only conceded one goal in the last six in all competitions, and Mendy provides that security. We're not even talking about the goalkeeper anymore. We're not even talking about the defence anymore. Chilwell, solid and dependable at left back. Zuma coming on a bundle alongside Silva and Azpilicueta or James. You know, pick anyone you want, and you're going to get good performances. And what that does, you know, United could take a leaf out of the Chelsea book. It provides a platform for the other players to express themselves. And if you look at, I'd go a stage further and say, when Kante plays in his, what I believe to be correct position, defensive midfield, the balance is there as well. You know, he's won the league with Leicester playing in that position, the World Cup with France playing in that position, the title with Chelsea playing in that position. Sometimes we can reinvent the wheel in football, can't we? And you get managers who come along, oh, he's got more industry and he does this if you play him a bit further forward. No, defensive midfield, you're doing okay. And I think the round pegs in the round holes are enabling Chelsea to move ominously back to where they were in the top four last season. But I believe even higher, I think Chelsea will challenge for the title again.
Ooh.
Oh, big call that.
Big call.
But I suppose...
Well, why do you disagree?
I just think they probably need a season to bed in to find out who they are. You know, you can see it happening, and sometimes through almost circumstance. You'd think about it on Saturday. Pulisic had that hamstring issue. That almost had an enforced result in terms of Havertz and Mason Mount really discovering themselves together. You know, they were picking the ball up a bit deeper. So they're developing. And, you know, I take your point. And they might well have a really good challenge this season for all the reasons we talked about at the top of the show about, you know, it is so unpredictable and we might end up with an 80-point champion. But I think they just probably need one more year. What do you think about the overall way that Frank Lampard has dealt with the pressure of this situation, Addy?
I think he's dealt with it really well. I think he's been calm. I think he's probably behind the scenes always said to himself, look, let me just get my defensive unit set up. You know, you think of the team that played against Liverpool and Christiansen played, Alonso played and Kepa played. He's replaced Christiansen with Thiago Silva. Kepa has been replaced by Mendy. And Chilwell's come in for Alonso. And I think you always want him to judge him, or I want him to judge him anyway, when he had his back five set up and the guys going forward. And I think he's done, I think he's handled that well. What he's done very importantly, and Darren alluded to it there, was getting Kante in the right position. Kante is so important to Chelsea. And look, Kante's been played on right wing, which is just ridiculous. He's been played as an attacking midfielder. And it just makes no sense. Kante, as a defensive holding city midfielder, I think probably the best in the league. I think him and Fabinho are probably heads and shoulders above everyone. And maybe Fernandinho when he's fit as well. So I think he's finally got the 11 he wants on the pitch. He's got squad depth as well now. You see Giroud coming on the other day. Callum Hudson-Odoi still there. Pulisic is a worry because I think he's their one real magical Hazard-like player. But I think Lampard's done a good job quietly climbing up the lead and quietly keeping clean sheets as well. And you compare that to the 3 against West Brom, the 3 against Southampton. I think he's dealt with those situations very well for a manager that's not been in management for so long.
Can I drop in a 10 quick seconds of a reply in so much as I agree with both your points on Pulisic, but I think the great thing they have at the moment that underlines my point about their title chance is depth. Because I expected them to get rid of a lot of players after they did their business, but they kept hold of a lot. Ziyech is versatile and can play across the front three. They've got Callum Hudson-Odoi as well, who can play off the left. They've got Timo Werner, who obviously does play off the left. You know, they've got Havertz, they've got Abraham, they've got Giroud if they need more experience and aerial ability. They've just got so much that they didn't have last season, and the competition is so strong. I think the back five and the defensive midfield now takes care of itself. It's the combinations that they have at their disposal in the final third that give them that chance. And teams that are going to win leagues have sound defences and score goals. I think Chelsea tick the boxes on both counts.
Okay then, Darren, let's talk about Spurs, which is a team that you know well. They're second as we sit here. Gareth Bale won them the game on Sunday. You know, look, his quality is unchallengeable. How long do you think it will take him to get up to speed?
I think he's nearly there, you know. I think he is... What's helped him massively is that Kane and Son have been in such sensational form so far this season. I would imagine they've been inspired by his arrival because they're going to be desperate to play alongside him. And they've been on fire. And I think their form has also inspired him to want to play with them as well. So I think when they eventually do end up playing together, they're going to be some front three. But I don't think he's that far away. He had some Europa League game time last week. I think they'll be fine in Europa League. I'm not too worried about what happened in the game against Antwerp. I think that they are being very careful with him. I think that the level of their confidence is underlined by that little dig in the press conference from Mourinho, talking about wanting to go on safari. Mourinho, you've got to get yourself a better browser than that to find, get the app, and he's going to have a look at Marca to see what they're saying about him. You only really start shouting your mouth off when you're fairly convinced that, you know, the player's doing well, and it does look very much. You know what I liked about the goal he scored in the game against Brighton was the confidence as he took it. You know, it wasn't a snatch header, free header. It was directed. It was classy. And it was. I think Bale is a guy who's coming in back into his own again in familiar surroundings, surrounded by quality players. And I think that we are going to be eulogising about him in a Spurs shirt again before long. He is... They look in terrific shape. I'm still not convinced by their defence, but certainly as far as Bale is concerned, I can't wait to see him in full flight alongside Kane and Son.
Speaking of Kane, is the halo slipping a little bit, Addy? You know, he's been known within the game for winning penalties by backing in, and it does look a bit dangerous, to be perfectly honest. So is he being sort of rumbled?
Slightly, but I think... What Kane does, we see across every club in the Premier League. I saw Salah do something very similar against West Ham on the weekend as well. Everyone seems to do it now. Everyone seems to know how to win free kicks and win penalties. Harry Kane is no different. Going back to what Darren was saying about this Gareth Bale's inclusion in the squad and Gareth and Tottenham in general now, I think Tottenham are playing fantastic football right now. I really do. I think Kane and Son, that combination is just fantastic. Harry Kane has shown a lot more depth to his game, almost Kevin De Bruyne-like passing now ability, which I didn't think he had. I think Doherty coming in from Wolves is a great signing. Reguilon, I think, is going to be a very, very good signing for them as well. And Højbjerg, who I think needs to be given a lot more plaudits. A lot of plaudits has been given to Kane and Son, and rightly so. But Højbjerg, who got so much stick first game of the season against Everton with people asking about receipts and sending back, I think he's quietly shown why him and Ndombele in midfield could be a really, really good partnership. What this means for Dele Alli, I have absolutely no idea, because I just can't see a way in which he forces his way back into that squad. And I say
he needs to get out. He needs to get out the club, doesn't he?
He really does. Honestly, he really does. Look, he's only 24. Even if it's just a loan deal, you look at what Ross Barkley did in leaving Chelsea. And he's come on leaps and bounds at Aston Villa. I think Dele Alli should look to do the same thing. I think he needs to go. There was talk about PSG. A lot of people laughed at that. He could possibly go PSG. If Moise Keane can go PSG, there's a good chance Dele Alli can go PSG and get some minutes somewhere. But he does need to get out of the game. I mean, he does need to leave the club. He clearly isn't the Dele Alli of 16-17 that scored, 22 goals in 17-18, where I think he got 14. He needs to move and just find the pastures new, because I don't think he fits exactly what Mourinho wants to do. Mourinho likes men. He likes having big men leaders on the pitch. And I don't think Dele Alli fits that right now.
Yeah, I suppose if we look at the teams doing well early on, Southampton and Wolves fit that bill. Do you expect those two teams to sustain their form, Darren?
Southampton, yeah. In fact, it's quite good that we're talking about teams like that outside the top six, because I think it's particularly Southampton, I'm not sure they get the credit they deserve. Hasenhüttl's built a team. It's quite interesting watching them play against Villa. 8 of the 11 had started the previous game. He does like a consistency in his side and in defence as well. I was guilty of maybe not thinking that much of Yannick Vestergaard. But yeah, I think he could do with a bit more pace. But at the same time, you know. Well, no, I tell you why I say that. I watched Timo Werner roll him at Stamford Bridge and then split away from him so quickly. And you know, he'd left dust in his wake and Vestergaard was nowhere near it. And I just, to be fair, you're talking about an elite forward, really, in Werner. So maybe I'm being a little bit harsh. But there was nothing poor about the way that he took his goal yesterday against Aston Villa. Great movement, great header, and such a force at set pieces for Southampton, and really, really good performance in the game as well during that first half where they could have scored 5 or 6. And I just think that Hasenhüttl has done such a good job, A, with his recruitment, and B, with the motivation of the players. And everyone talks about that result, which I'm not going to mention, but it's consigned now to history for me, because I think that what he has done has not been... What he's done is he's coached the players. He's coached them back to where they are now. He's given them confidence. He's given them a very clear idea about what he wants to achieve in this most ridiculous of seasons. You wouldn't even bet against them finishing, you know, in the top 8. You know, that they are a good club who over the years had a really good track record of bringing players through and selling them on for big money. And the Walcott was a great example of that. He's back. And I almost wonder if we could see him helping Walcott to be something like the player. He'll never be the player that left up Southampton in a million years now. But, you know, just getting some kind of consistency in his game, because he's playing with players who are in the... such a good moment at the moment. And I've got to give special mention to James Ward-Prowse, because the quality of those free kicks was simply outstanding, and the assist as well for Vestergaard's goal. And yeah, I think it's down to Hasenhüttl because he is the guy who empowers those players with the confidence to go and express themselves, and they're doing a terrific job.
Mike, can I quickly just mention Wolves there, because we touched on them, and I think they deserve a mention as well, because I started this, well, about 2 weeks ago, I said we could have another Leicester season where a team just shocks us. And I like Wolves because Wolves, look, last season, I think they kind of limped over the line just because they were playing in Europe as well. There is no Europe for them this season. I think they've kept the players they wanted to keep in Jimenez and Traore and Neves. I think Connor Cody is a fantastic defender, and I'm so happy he's got the England call-up as well. And I feel like they could do something, Wolves, this season. I think they've got one of the best coaches in the league in Nuno Santo. And I just feel like we shouldn't sleep on Wolves. No Europe this season. Again, that was a big burden for them last season, playing Thursday, Sunday with a very small squad. They don't have it this season. If they can keep Traore and Jimenez and Neves fit, they could be a danger this season, a real big danger.
Yeah, well, I take that point and also add that they've also got the Mendes dividend, haven't they, if you think about it. but, look, you think about it. On Friday's game, Rayan Aitnouri. Now, it's signed from Angers, no fanfare. The scouts that I know were raving about him. But in essence, he was their fourth choice left wing back. Now, one performance, one goal on his debut. They've got a loan. He's on loan, but there's the option to buy for 15 million euros, which will definitely be taken up. So that does tell you that there is a lot of substance to that squad. If a kid, I think he's 19, can come in and make that impact, it means that there's a real store of talent there. Just want to draw things to a conclusion by talking about the creation of the FA's diversity code, and specifically one of those guys who helped draw that up, Wes Morgan. You know, you mentioned, Ali, about Leicester. Obviously, he had that role in the Premier League win as captain. He strikes me as a potential leader of the future. Is that fair, do you think?
I think so. Look, he's revered at the club. He commands so much respect from the players and those higher. He has a presence behind the scenes. And I think he's a fantastic role model as well. But you put all that aside, this is a guy that has a certificate in football business management. So, you know, it wouldn't be a box-ticking exercise. He's qualified for the role. And I think that's why I think he can be a good leader, not just because he deserves it because of all the things I mentioned at the top, but because he's actually qualified for the role. Goes back to players like Ledley King becoming assistant manager at Tottenham because he's qualified. Les Ferdinand, the job he does at QPR because he's qualified. Wes Morgan ticks all those boxes. He's qualified for the role. And I think even when that role does come into fruition, they're talking about next season, but watching him against AEK Athens, I don't know. There's still a player in there. He could go on and on and on, Wes Morgan, but even when he gets into the position, he's not doing it because he's ticking a box because he's a black player. He's doing it because he can do that role. I've spoken to Wes Morgan a few times myself, and he's an articulate person, comes across very bold and strong. And I think he'll do a fantastic job for Leicester, even when that role does happen.
Addy, are you convinced, Addy, by the code?
Absolutely not. I feel like these things all sound fantastic on the outside, but I'm almost a person that sits back and waits for results. I wait and see what's going to happen in 12 to 18 months. Are we going to get results? Are people going to be put into positions and slots? Or is it just a case of, okay, we're setting something up with no substance? I think it's a bit of the latter, but I wait to be checked. So I'm going to give it 12 to 18 months. I'm going to put my feet up, have a cigar, put my slippers on and wait to see what happens.
Yeah, oh, I bet you'll have a cold one as well.
Oh, certainly.
To add his point, Darren, the buy-in does seem impressive, but presumably that only tells half the story because you have to follow through on it. And was it 15% representation in new executive jobs, 25% in coaching? To be honest, that will take, well, one, it's a leap of faith, but two, it will take an awful lot to get to those figures in the sort of timescale they're talking about, won't it?
Absolutely, it will. I applaud the fact that we've come at this from a positive way because the likes of Wes Morgan and others, Paul Elliott, they've worked hard, and we have to recognise they've worked hard to get this code up and running. But football history has told us that it is very easy to buy into something that looks good in PR terms. A lot harder to convince people or to tell people how they should spend their money in football. Owners and chairmen who have their own contacts and their own people that they lean on and rely on. And that's why we are where we are with only, what, a handful of managers out of 91 who are black. And so Wes Morgan's leadership credentials and his qualifications may well be outstanding, but he doesn't actually at this point stand a better chance than any of the other outstandingly qualified managers, former players, when he is in search of a job, because the will might change and the talk and the rhetoric might be different. But it's about results. It's about who is willing to put their money where their mouth is. And there are too few owners and chairmen in football, let's not kid ourselves, who are willing to do that. And when you talk about the stats, Mike, the targets that we've set are low. And I'm not talking about this from the outside. I've been involved in, you know, saying this to the relevant people. I think the targets are low. And the argument has been that the pathway isn't open. I reject that utterly. There are coaches who have taken their badges, done the work, got the experience, but just can't get a look in. So nobody's convincing me that we don't have the talent kicking its heels. And it just strikes me that maybe we're waiting for a generation to, you know, to move on and give up, and then another young players are going to be potentially sated by this whole idea, oh, just be a bit patient, your time will come. And that is what we have to push back against right now. We have to draw a line in the sand and say, no, we're not going to wait. Something's got to change right now.
Well, it's all about keeping the pressure on, isn't it, I suppose. Now, we've all been hit by a tsunami of bad news recently, but there was something particularly distressing when it was confirmed that Sir Bobby Charlton is suffering from dementia. He's the fifth member of England's World Cup winning team diagnosed with a terribly, terribly cruel disease. The football world's already mourning Nobby Stiles, the seventh member of Sir Alf Ramsey's team to pass away. He was one of four players to fall victim to dementia or Alzheimer's disease. Now, I know that's a small sample, but the incidence in that team alone is more than four times the national average. A study last year found that former footballers were 3.5 times more likely to suffer from dementia. How much has changed in the 18 years since the coroner ruled that Jeff Astle had died of what the coroner said was an industrial disease? Too little, in spite of the unceasing efforts of his daughter Dawn. She remains the game's unsung heroine. The football authorities need to accelerate their efforts to protect the next generation. What would you like to see done? Please let me know. And in the meantime, thanks to Darren and Addy and to you for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.